Well, happy Father's Day, everyone. I hope you enjoyed those little insights from your pastors about fatherhood in that video today. I would ask you this. Does your family have any messed up stories? I mean, my brother had a close encounter that almost ruined him. Okay, my great-grandma, we called her Granny. She had moved into my parents' house. My mom and dad very compassionately took her in for end-of-life care. And her mind was kind of starting to slip by this point. She was doing some crazy stuff like, you know, putting salad dressing on her cereal and worse than that. But the kicker was, one night in the wee hours of the morning when she had wandered out of her bedroom in her birthday suit and innocently climbed into bed with my 16-year-old brother, Brandon. Now, I was in college at the time, but rumor has it that his screams of horror reverberated through the house for hours. I mean, that's pretty messed up. And it's become kind of part of our family folklore at most holiday gatherings. You remember that time when Granny, you know. And most families have some stories like this. But some of you also have some messed up family stories that aren't so funny. Stories of struggle and difficulty, of pain and brokenness, maybe even abuse. And the question is, how does someone survive that? Or even overcome that? And so today, we start a brand new teaching series about the life of Joseph called Seven Questions of Faith and Doubt. Each week will be framed around a question that's connected to the life of Joseph. But the questions are one I think that all of us can relate to. And so here's today's question. Can I survive a messed up family? It sounds like a pretty good one for Father's Day sermon, right? Am I right, dads? Right, dads, we can be pretty messed up sometimes. And the dad that we look to in this story today, named Jacob, he's no exception. But let me just say this. Dads get a pretty bad rap in our society. It seems like every TV show, every sitcom has a completely emasculated and disrespected dad. Moms are often portrayed as the strong and in control and sympathetic characters. Dads tend to not get a whole lot of credit. But I want to give you a few statistics today that I found very, very interesting. Here's the first one. 93% of American fathers are actually more skilled at expressing verbal affection to their children than the average American mom. Here's the second. The average American dad spends 4 hours more per week doing household chores than moms who work outside the home, if you include yard work and auto maintenance. Here's the third. The American father, on average, gives caring physical touch to young children 3 times more often per day than the average American mom. Aren't those statistics really interesting? Now, unfortunately, none of them are true because I just made them all up. But they're pretty interesting nonetheless, aren't they? Oh, man, I could feel the temperature in the room rising from the seething mothers. Come on, it's just a joke today. It's Father's Day. Let's go. Anyway, kidding aside, a dad's job in our world today is really hard. And fathers who are doing it well and taking their best swing at the plate, they deserve high praise. And so I want to thank you, dads. We appreciate you very much. And we're going to be in Genesis 37 today. If you have your Bible or device, you can turn there. Genesis is the book at the very beginning of your Bible. Hopefully you received a devotional book when you came in today. If not, you can raise your hand right now. One of our guest experience team members will make sure that you get one. If you're watching online, you can go to the link and download a copy electronically. But today we're going to look at a family dynamic that was pretty messed up. In fact, if you look closely, there are no real healthy families in the Bible, no real models of excellence in the family department. They're all pretty broken, which should give us all hope. I mean, because some of you come from broken, dysfunctional families. Actually, all of us do at some level. And we're wondering how to overcome all of that. And so today, we're going to draw some lessons from Joseph's story to answer that question. Now, let me set the stage here for a moment. God had made a promise to Father Abraham that his people would become a great nation and would bring hope and rescue to the world. This would eventually be the nation of Israel and would provide the lineage for Jesus, the Messiah, to come. There were 3 original patriarchs to the Jewish people, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And Jacob is the father in our story today. And eventually, God changed Jacob's name to Israel, which is the name you'll hear in today's text as well. Now, Joseph, who's the main character of our series for the next 2 months, he was the second youngest of Jacob's 12 sons. And though Abraham and Isaac and Jacob are given substantial attention in the book of Genesis, it becomes Joseph's story right here in chapter 37 through chapter 50. Over a fourth of the Bible's first book is given to Joseph. Even though Jacob had other sons to other women, Joseph was the firstborn son of Jacob's one true love named Rachel. Therefore, Joseph was most highly favored by his dad, which means he was most highly hated by the rest of his family. So we're going to dive into the first four verses of chapter 37 with a view toward the end of the story. And our big idea today is that God can turn your messes into miracles. As you will see, this family story starts as a big, old, fat mess. So let's look at Genesis 37, starting in verse 1. Jacob lived in the land of his father's sojournings, in the land of Canaan. These are the generations of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was pasturing the flock with his brothers. He was a boy with the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought a bad report of them to their father. Now Israel, that's Jacob, loved Joseph more than any of the other sons because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a robe of many colors. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peacefully to him. Now, we're going to look at this family today and try to learn from some of their mistakes. And these lessons can be applied to dads for sure, but they're also universal. And so everyone should pay attention to the lessons here. We're going to discover in this passage four clues for overcoming a messed up family. Here's the first clue. The first clue is to weed out generational sins. You know, a lot of the dysfunction that occurred in this family was because Jacob didn't deal with sinful patterns from his family of origin. We see right off the bat that Jacob, the father of the family, loved Joseph more than any of his other sons. Now, the story behind that is a bit convoluted and long, but here it is in a nutshell. Jacob grew up desperately lacking the love and affirmation of his father, Isaac, because Isaac overtly and clearly had a favorite son. It was Jacob's brother Esau. Some of you who grew up in Sunday school will remember the story of Esau, the hairy one. I mean, Esau was the guy who took his shirt off at the pool and everybody's like, whoa, 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 dude, put it back on, right? He had a serious Sasquatch look going on, and he was his dad's favorite. Esau was the hunter, he was the fisher and gatherer, and Jacob was his twin. He was not any of those things, but Jacob was tricky. He was crafty. And when his dad was old and blind, he managed to maneuver his way into stealing the inheritance from his brother. Jacob covered himself in animal fur so that he would feel hairy like Esau to his dad. And throughout his life, he had lied and deceived and lied and deceived some more until he finally, at the end of his dad's life, stole his brother's birthright. This all started because he lacked affirmation from his dad. His dad had a favorite and it wasn't him. And this lack of affirmation resulted in an inner neediness that drove the rest of Jacob's life in many ways. And one of the things that it drove him to was to utterly fix his heart on this beautiful woman named Rachel. In his heart, Jacob thought something like, man, if I had her, then she would finally fix the brokenness in my life. And he did whatever it took to get her, including pathological lying again and again and again. And he did eventually marry Rachel. And she did eventually give him two sons, Joseph and Benjamin, in addition to 10 sons from other women. But Rachel died while giving birth to Benjamin, and that empty hole opened back up in Jacob's heart. And so after Rachel died, Joseph became the new emotional center of this father's life. And do you see what's happening here? This guy who had lived his whole life on the short end of his dad's favoritism had a chance to put an end to that. He had a chance to stop that cycle, a chance to get true healing. And instead, we see him lavishing money and gifts and a very fancy robe on Joseph in a way that he didn't to any of his other children. In other words, Joseph had become the idol of Jacob's life. And when the world revolves around a child, it will poison the entire family system. We should take note of that. Let me just stop here and ask, is there a cycle of sin in your family that you need to put to an end? I mean, I imagine that Jacob grew up watching his dad love Esau more than him, and he said again and again, when I become a father, I'll never do that to my kids. I'll never have a favorite like that. And then Joseph comes along and boom, he's right back into that generational cycle. Is there anything like that that you need to put an end to today? Some sin from your family's past. Maybe it was alcoholism or verbal or emotional abuse or neglect or workaholism. Maybe addiction to TV or sports or money. Maybe laziness. Anything from your family of origin that you swore you would never repeat. And lo and behold, here you are. Generational sin, you see, is a powerful force. If you grew up in dysfunction and if you're not intentional, you will become your parents and you will repeat their sins and mistakes. Or, listen, or you will become so hell-bent on not becoming them that you will sin on the opposite extreme. The sins of your family's past will catch up with you in unexpected ways if you don't root them out. You know, we have a ministry here every Monday night at Grace called Celebrate Recovery. We have on Tuesday nights a powerful prayer ministry called Experience Prayer. We have a partnership at all times with an incredible counseling center called Christian Counseling Associates at our different locations. You can find some details on all of these ministries in your sermon notes, but I want to encourage you that if generational sin is rising up in your own heart and in your own life, get it dealt with, because it won't just affect you, it'll start to affect your kids. Dads, I want to send a special challenge your way on this Father's Day. Don't normalize the sinful patterns of your family's past. You owe it to yourself, to your wife, to your kids, to your God, to just declare, this thing stops with me. It stops with me. I'm not passing this cycle on anymore. Remember, I mentioned that Jacob had turned to pathological lying to deal with his own emptiness. Well, Joseph, we find here in our story, was 17 years old. And in verse 2, it says, he brought their father a bad report about his half-brothers. You remember this? The Hebrew word here for bad report is a word that always means through the scripture, false report. It was a lie, or it was at least a misrepresentation of some kind. And so Joseph here is a kid who's already turning into a liar. The hidden sins of the father, you see, are being passed on to the son. And God would help Joseph to break this cycle. And so the first clue of overcoming a messed up family is to weed out generational sins. Here's the second, is to affirm the uniqueness of each family member. Look at verse 3 again, and I want to talk about this colorful robe for a minute. The robe became the expression of this father's love and affection for Joseph. It says that this child is special, this child is prized, this child is valued above all the others. And listen, we may not give robes to our children today, but what about extra time? What about extra attention or extra affection? And just think about Jacob's other children for a minute. I mean, when a child learns that he or she will never wear the robe, that he or she will never light up their father's eyes, something inside that child dies. And when a robe is handed out to only one child and withheld from the others as an act of favoritism, that sets in motion forces of hostility and jealousy and envy that will destroy the family community that is so precious to God. Instead of being ranked, each child should be celebrated. John Ortberg said it this way. He said, God has sovereignly custom designed each family member with varied interests and academic potentials and leadership quotients and energy levels and personalities and temperaments. And we can either affirm the uniqueness of each one of them and thank God for the unique gift that each special creation is and encourage and inspire them to mature and develop in accordance with that uniqueness, or we can unintentionally send out signals that say, I wish you would act more like Bobby. I wish you would study more like Jenny. You should have interests more like me. You should perform academically at this level or at that level. And sometimes those oughts and shoulds add up to the realization in the mind of the child that he or she is not really appreciated for who God created them to be. This doesn't mean that we affirm sinfulness in our children. Let me just be clear on that. Like they get caught stealing another kid's lunch money at school and you go, well, that's just who God made him to be. No, that's not what we're talking about here. We have to still bring godly values and discipline to the table, but even the discipline should reflect the uniqueness of that child. God made them all different. Kim and I often talk about in terms of capturing the hearts of our kids, trying to study them and observe them, each in a way that we could first understand, but then ultimately help to unleash and empower them at a heart level, because all of our kids are different. It's one of the lessons that I think we can apply to our homes from the church world and even from the business world these days. It's the lesson of team. Team has become such a buzzword in our culture, but many people, many of you are tasked at work or at church with helping teams to function well, to make sure that each person's talents are unlocked and they perform their role. Well, what if you imagined your family as a team? each member with a unique contribution to bring and a role to play in that family. That uniqueness would first need to be identified and called out, and then nurtured and utilized for the good of the whole team, the whole family. Think of each kid and each spouse having a special contribution to make to your team. It could change the dynamic of your entire family. But by favoring just one, other family members will begin to distort themselves to try to become who you want them to be, even if it isn't remotely connected to who God made them to be. Dads, what would it look like for you to affirm the uniqueness of each member of your family? How are you doing on this one? How would you score yourself? I mean, speaking of scoring, don't you wish, dads, that there was some kind of fatherhood scorecard by which you could measure yourself? I mean, Gene Apple mentioned this in a message, and I'm on board with this idea. I mean, a lot of us, we're feedback junkies. We grew up in kind of a performance-based world where we can measure how we're doing based on wins and loss records or in sports or GPAs in school or profit and loss margins in our jobs. We like hard, objective numbers that tell us where we are in the standings. But in the dad world, the data is a little fuzzy. I mean, I think we'd be more comfortable if being a dad could be scored and could be made into a kind of a competitive sport. Like, I'm in third place right now, but two more fishing trips and I should qualify for the dad playoffs, you know, something like that. Or we could even do dad trash talk. You know, you call that being a father. I mean, get that weak stuff out of here. You call that quality time with your kid. I'll show you quality time with you, right? I think we'd be more comfortable with that kind of arrangement. But instead, when you become a dad, you make an investment, and you may not see the return on that investment for many years. In fact, you may never see it. It requires the patience to keep on going without knowing the score. And often you'll go through long stretches of time where you don't really know how well you're doing. But the day-to-day grind of affirming the uniqueness of each family member, I promise you it will pay off. Now, you may be watching this and you're not a parent, or you may not be married, but you have a family. And so what would it look like to celebrate each member's uniqueness? It's one of the ways that we can avoid or overcome a messed up family situation. Here's the third clue. It's to be fully present. It's so easy for us to check out these days, isn't it? So many people just live checked out lives, maybe checked out emotionally, just don't have a real connection with their emotions at any moment, maybe checked out mentally or even physically. It's so easy to spend a little bit more time at work, a little bit more time in the bathtub or the bathroom taking refuge, a little bit more time on our devices. You know, I was doing some research this week for a different talk. Did you know that when you interact with your device or social media, that your brain actually releases a chemical called dopamine? It's the same chemical that's released when people drink or smoke or gamble. It's highly addictive. And these days, it's so easy to escape real life and to take refuge in our electronic addiction. Simon Sinek said that these devices are keeping us from actually being human in some basic ways. He advocates collecting cell phones at the door of meetings at work because people are arriving in the meeting and they sit around the table in the 3 to 5 minutes before the meeting starts and they just stare at their devices. We're just constantly like this. He says, before, there would be these small talk moment interactions like, hey, Bob, I heard your dad was in the hospital. Yeah, it's been hard to see him like that. Well, please know that my thoughts and prayers are with your family. Those little interactions. And Sinek says that a bunch of those little interactions each day is part of actually what makes us human. But we're not having them anymore because our heads are constantly down in our devices. We've checked out. And I fear that many of us are not fully present in our homes either. We get some context clues in this passage today that Jacob had checked out a bit with his family too. Next week, we're going to see how Joseph was sold by his brothers into slavery. And later in the story, we'll find that it took Jacob the better part of 2 decades to realize what had truly become of his favorite son, Joseph. He was so disengaged from the other sons, from the rest of his family, that he never got to the bottom of the story. I'm not sure he ever cared to. I think Jacob is the case of someone who was just wasn't fully present or engaged with his family. And when you mentally check out, man, bad stuff starts brewing. Look at verse 4. It says, but when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, it says they hated who? I mean, this is interesting. The question is, who are the brothers going to hate? Who are they going to get angry at? Whose fault in this story is it? Who is the person that's done something wrong? It's their father, Jacob. He's the one that played favorites. He's the one that gave away the robe. But it doesn't say that they grew angry at Jacob. It says they grew angry at Joseph, their brother. And I believe the author here, Moses, is just profoundly accurate about the way that favoritism and jealousy works in the real world. The boys don't get angry at their father, maybe because they don't want to face the truth that they're lower on the totem pole. That would hurt too much. And so they get angry at Joseph. It says they couldn't speak peaceably to him. They couldn't say a kind word to him. The word peace here is shalom. It's the old Hebrew word for the well-being and flourishing of any group, in this case, a family. It wasn't existent in this family, mainly because dad hadn't been fully present with all his kids. I mean, consider this word to parents, just a few books over in Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy 6, 6 and 7. It says, these commands that I give you today are to be on your hearts. Impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit at home and when you walk along the road, when you lie down and when you get up. You see, every clause in this sentence speaks of a personal connection between parents and children. And the full picture is of interaction throughout the day. And yes, careers and school schedules and extracurricular activities, they all have a place in your day. But our goal in family must be personal connection. I mean, you've heard us talk about these 936 weeks. It's the number of weeks between when your child's born and when they're 18 and leave the house. And we have such a short time to make an impact on our kids' lives. Don't miss a single moment. When you sit at home, when you walk along the road, when you lie down, when you get up. I just want to take a moment now and encourage a group of people that are watching this today. That's single parents. I want to recognize the fact that in our midst today are many single parents, and they face a monumental task. For both single moms and single dads, Father's Day can often be a painful day because life's difficult enough. And then you come to a place like this and you add in all this talk about how indispensable fathers are. It can make a day like this much harder. And so I want to take a moment to stop and to recognize that all of you in our midst who are raising and nurturing and supporting a family as single parents, you face a Herculean task. And your perseverance and your faithfulness and your determination in the face of overwhelming obstacles is an inspiration to all of us. And it's honorable in the sight of God. And I just want to remind you today that you're all heroes. Can we appreciate these single parents right now? So our four clues for overcoming a messed up family are: weed out generational sins, affirm the uniqueness of each family member, be fully present, and here's the fourth clue. It's to recognize God is the true hero of your story. This story of Joseph gets off to a pretty rough start. It's a pretty messed up family. And don't forget, this is the covenant family. These are supposed to be God's people. These are the models. This is the family through whom God will bless the nations. And this seems like a hopeless triangle right now. A favorite boy, a foolish father, furious brothers. And by the way, God is not mentioned at all in this chapter, but he's everywhere. He's in the midst of all of this dysfunction. And by the end of the story, we're going to see that God, in his providence, has made a way for life-changing forgiveness and reconciliation. Even though each family member really screws things up, God creates the atmosphere in the end for healing. You see, God can turn your messes into miracles. And we're going to see this play out in Joseph's life over these next 7 weeks. But don't ever think that your family is the only messed up family and that your family is too broken for God to work. Because I wish Joseph was here to testify to you today that no pit is too deep where the love of God is not deeper still. And there's no prison so remote that the freedom of God cannot break in. And there's no family so dysfunctional that the grace of God cannot bring healing and restoration. Joseph's life proves that even in the midst of a crazy family, God can be the hero. And so dads, the greatest gift that you can give to your family is a Christ-centered heart. You can never do enough yourself to bring perfect protection, perfect provision, perfect health, and wholeness to your family. But there is one who can. And when he's at work, even the great mistakes that you have made can be redeemed. To paraphrase the words of Eugene Peterson, He gives this great statement and basically says that the Bible is filled with these stories of imperfect families. Adam and Eve, the first couple, they raised a murderer. Noah's children had to hide their father's drunken shamefulness. David has an affair. Even in the family of Jesus, where we might expect something different, his mother and brothers show up at one of his healings and try to get him to come home, quite sure that he is absolutely crazy. The Bible consistently portrays the family not as a Norman Rockwell painting, but as a series of broken relationships in need of redemption. And these biblical accounts are not to show us examples of what to be like or not to be like. They're to remind us that we all desperately need redemption. We need God to intervene. God's always doing a million things that we can't see. And if your family situation feels hopeless, remember this dysfunctional family that we studied today in Genesis 37. God can answer prayers better than we can even ask them. He's the true hero of the story. Guys, I know for some of you, this is a tough day. Maybe you're a dad who struggled with some of this stuff. Maybe you have a dad who failed you. And every year you walk down the aisle and look at those Father's Day cards and they don't write them to say what you really want them to say. Maybe you lost your dad and this day is filled with memories and some sadness and longing for days gone by. And listen, some of you have fantastic dads and you're truly celebrating his impact on your life today. In all of those cases, let me remind you that God is still the true hero. He is the perfect father. He is for you. He will be with you every step of your life. His motive is always love. When you think that he's out to spoil your fun, he's actually protecting you from something that will harm you. He will pick you up if you fall. He will bind your wounds. He will set you on your feet again. He wants the absolute best for you in all you do. He doesn't want you to settle for less than the best. He's the ultimate father. He's the hero. Let us remember that today. And as we close, I want to walk you through some next steps. And to do that, I want to just address some different groups of you that may understand a messed up family from a little different angle. Now, just a quick reminder, we're all messed up, okay? So no one's being singled out here. First, let me talk to dads and really all parents. For you today, would you just pick one of these lessons to work on? Weed out generational sinfulness. Affirm the uniqueness of each family member. Be fully present. Recognize God as the true hero. So some of you, the main step that you need to take today is just to humble yourself and say, God, help. God, help. Just admit that you need him. Just admit, God, I don't have the wisdom. I don't have the relational intelligence. I don't have the strength. God, I'll give it my best shot. I'll read some books. I'll readjust my vacation plans. I'll rethink my schedule. I'll do my part. But God, I need your help. I can't do it without you. Have you done that? Because without that kind of commitment, days turn into weeks. Weeks turn into months. Months turn into years. And before you know it, it's just slipped by you. Life, fatherhood. You might get 936 weeks to mark your kids. You might get less. And so I'm begging you, don't waste one. Don't waste a single one trying to do it on your own. Which of these areas do you need to commit to God? Now, let me talk to those who may have related to a different aspect of today's message. Some of you were kids who never wore the robe. You never received the kind of affirmation and love that you longed for. You never had that sense of being prized and valued. A couple of things for you. Would you first acknowledge the hurt? I mean, for most of your life, it's been easier to express hatred than hurt. Would you just acknowledge the hurt? Would you renounce envious actions? Just say, I won't give in to the temptation to gossip or slander or tear down other people, because that's the temptation. That's the coping mechanism. Just give that up. And then, would you accept God's love as your ultimate father? 1 John 3:1 says, behold, what manner of love the Father lavishes on us that we might be called a child of God. Would you make that your own verse? Would you put your name in there and memorize it? That Derek might be called a child of God, that Mary, that Sue, that whoever might be called a child of God. You are loved by the Father. The third group I want to talk to is those of you who wore the robe. You were the favorite growing up. Maybe the family kind of revolved around you. If that's you, congratulations, but let me point out that you were damaged in some more subtle ways because of that. Maybe you became addicted to wearing the robe. Now that's carried you into adulthood. And now you don't feel valued without the attention. I mean, think about it. Joseph's robe isolated him. And he learned very quickly, and might I add, providentially, what life was like without the robe. God went to great lengths to humble Joseph, to shape his character, and to break him out of this mold. And so if this is you, you may need to put yourself in places where you're not the center of attention, where you're not the one that holds all the power, where you're not the one that holds all the cards, where you don't have to have the last word, and learn to rejoice in the value of others. So I ask you today, what's the step that you need to take? We're going to spend just a moment here in a silent reflection around these next steps. God bless you. Happy Father's Day.